From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Does the phrase vegan milk chocolate sound like an oxymoron? Well, it's not. Botanist Brad Kinzer has been working with cacao for more than two decades. As the chief chocolate maker for Berkeley-based company Cho, he spent years developing sustainable ways to produce chocolate. Most recently, that includes a complete pivot to plant-based milk chocolate. Hi, Brad.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
I'm great. I'm very happy to talk about chocolate in any form. Let's get a bit of chocolate 101. What do chocolate makers need to make it?
Well, chocolate in its most simple form is just the combination of cocoa beans, which is a tropical seed that's grown on the cocoa tree, or also known as the cacao tree, Theobroma cacao. It's native to the Amazon, but it's grown all over the world and primarily grown in West Africa. That seed, the cocoa bean, is basically a high fat seed. The seed is typically harvested from the cocoa fruit. Actually, something a lot of people don't realize is that chocolate is a fermented food. And then the seeds are dried, after which they're roasted and they're ground down, typically with sugar, sometimes with milk to make a milk chocolate. That's it in a quick nutshell.
How many varieties of cacao are there?
There's sort of main groups of cacao. And just recently, in the last 5-7 years, they've done 5-10 years really now, they've done some really cool genetic analysis that's shown us that the diversity of cacao is really pretty much 11 or 12 main groups. And really, most of those groups are found in the area where cacao is native to, which is the Amazonian basin. But within that, those 12 groups, there's thousands of different varietals. So cacao is quite promiscuous. It can cross-pollinate and yield completely new varietals. And that's one of the most exciting things about being a chocolate maker, is that cacao as a tree crop is probably 100 years behind other fruits and foods that we know and love, such as grapes or apples or something like that.
So as a chocolate maker, what flavors are you looking for when you taste chocolate to use in the products you're trying to develop?
You know, within the cocoa bean, there can be up to or even over 600 different flavor compounds. Now, only about 30 or 40 of those are the predominant ones that give us the typical chocolate flavor, but even that is quite high compared to many other foods. So cacao is one of the most densely flavored foods known to humans. Many people think of chocolate as just being that sort of rich, fudgy, brownie profile, but actually there's chocolates that taste like tangerines. There's chocolates that taste very, very nutty. It's all in that realm of the genetics of the tree, how it's processed in the fermentation, the drying, and then the roasting and chocolate making side.
So right now you've been focusing with Cho on a line of vegan chocolates. Can you talk about what you had to eliminate to make the product plant-based and what kind of flavor profile you were looking for that may be different than what you would have been looking for in a product that wasn't totally plant-based?
Yeah, so we really had to start by looking deeply at what is it that people love about milk chocolate. You know, it was really the softness of a milk chocolate. It also has just a smoothness. So that silky smoothness comes from that softness of the milk fat. It also has a creaminess that's, you know, hard to recreate. And it also can have carameliness, which comes from the caramelization of the lactose, the sugars in milk. So that's where we get that nice big carameliness in a milk chocolate oftentimes. We probably did over 100 iterations of different versions, more than 100 really, of different versions of plant-based milk chocolates. And we found that putting a combination of different ingredients, plant-based ingredients together, really was able to unlock that key of giving us the softness, the carameliness, and the creaminess that we were looking for.
You know, I'm a milk chocolate person, and so I tend to be highly critical, because you were right on. I mean, it is, aside from the flavor, it is so much about that sensual mouthfeel that you get from a milk chocolate. And I had the experience of tasting the lineup, and I was so surprised by how right on you were. So what was the winner in terms of a plant-based milk that you ended up using?
We went through dozens of different types of ingredients, rice milk, soy milk, sunflower powder. I mean, everything you can imagine. You know, we basically were like, look, we're not going to make this unless we love it. We had plenty of time to play around with it and just, you know, wait for it to come to us, really. The winning combination that just was just hit it just the way we wanted it to was a combination of cashew butter. So cashew is a beautiful, mild flavor profile that melds perfectly with chocolate. A local roaster here in California made us a great custom cashew butter. And then we also found, you know, we explored oat milk. We tried a number of different oat milks. We couldn't quite find the right one. And then finally we found this one supplier that had a great quality, really clean, really creamy, not too sweet. And so that really came in perfectly. And then the final ingredient was was coconut sugar. And the coconut sugar really like allowed us to give that carameliness. The oat milk gave us the creaminess and the cashew butter gave us the softness. And none of it would have been possible if we didn't really find the best possible combination of cocoa bean. It's also a custom formula for the cocoa, how it's roasted and the origins and all that stuff. So really all those little levers were played with and adjusted.
Well, you succeeded, I have to say.
Oh, that's an honor. Thank you.
It might surprise people that many cocoa farmers are the poorest people in the world, and they haven't even tasted the final product.
Yeah, it's a sad part of how the world works right now. And maybe the work that I'm most proud of is the work that we've done to co-create our ingredients with our farmer partners. And that started right at the beginning of the Cho company. And it was, we realized that to make the chocolate we wanted to make, we needed to get cocoa beans that were phenomenal. And you can't just call up a cocoa farmer and just say, hey, send me this perfect quality bean. That's not how the supply chain works. So what we did is we identified, you know, some great partner communities, farming communities, several in Peru, several in Ecuador, Ghana, Dominican Republic. And we really went to work. This is many, many years, but one of the first things that we realized, a stumbling block, was that many of our cocoa farmer partners had never really tasted their own chocolate. And so when we were asking for specific unique flavor profiles or a reduction of other things like bitterness or mustiness or something like that, we realized that we had to set up a new system to be able to work with these farmers. What we did is we set up laboratories, which were basically small bean-to-bar laboratories that allowed farmers at origin, right at the cocoa farms, to make their own chocolate from their own beans. Then we did a lot of collaborative sensory work with those farmers so we could share with them, hey, this is what we're looking for. Maybe there's other chocolate companies that are looking for a different profile, but we're looking for this one. It really gave them a business tool to be able to make various qualities of cocoa and, you know, different flavor profiles and all of that. It's a scientific and a business tool for them. Over the course of about 8 or 10 years, there was about $5 million in premiums on top of their regular price that the farmer groups were able to acquire because they were able to make a better quality cocoa.
So has this plant-based chocolate become just an overall pivot rather than just the addition of another line of chocolate?
Yeah. So that's one of the things that we've really jumped off here. And we're moving away from dairy chocolate in general and moving to plant-based formula. Most dark chocolate is plant-based to begin with, in that it doesn't have dairy. So a lot of our chocolates aren't going to be changing, but the milk ones, we're excited to be making this big shift.
Brad Kinzer is the chief chocolate maker at Cho in Berkeley, California. We've been talking about what it takes to perfect plant-based chocolates. We've got links on where to buy them on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Nutritional yeast, nooch, Cheeto dust, whatever you call it, it's been a powerhouse in the vegan pantry for decades. And these days, it's also finding its way into the repertoire of many omnivores. Alicia Kennedy took a closer look at the flavor amplifier for Serious Eats. Hi, Alicia.
Hi, Evan.
It's so great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
So talk to us a bit about the history of nutritional yeast. When did it become popular amongst vegetarians?
Well, nutritional yeast has been a staple for vegans, at least since the 70s. One of the first vegan cookbooks that got really popular was called The Farm Vegetarian Cookbook, and it was from the Tennessee commune, The Farm, which still exists. And they used it rather liberally in their cookbooks for anything they wanted to make cheesy. And that's really how it's kind of stayed for a long time. It's really been something that gives a vegan cook, you know, something cheesy, umami, that is usually missing in a lot of plant foods. And because it is a source of B12, which is a vitamin that's only in animal foods or in supplements, it's also, you know, been a staple for nutritional reasons as well.
That's so interesting. Why do you think it's finding its way into the mainstream now, or it's having another flush of sort of popularity?
Well, it started, I think, to hit the mainstream in the last few years because people recognized it was a good popcorn topping because it's, you know, something cheesy and tastes a little salty because of the glutamate in it, but it's healthy, it's nutritious. And then you started to see it more and more outside of just vegan recipes. It became something people that like to use in salad dressings, marinades, that sort of thing. And so, you know, it has become a part of the omnivore's pantry because it is something that gives an easy kick of flavor. It stays fresh for a pretty long time at room temperature. And, you know, it's something that has that sheen of healthfulness to it.
What exactly is it? Is it related to the yeast that we use to make breads rise?
Well, it's something you would find in bread or beer. It's a living strain of a specific yeast that gets fed a glucose-rich carbohydrate like corn dextrose or beet molasses inside fermentation chambers. This process cultivates the yeast, letting it grow cell by cell, and it forms proteins that make up its cell walls, and that takes maybe 2 weeks. Then it's heated, pasteurized, dried, and that kills it. And so when the cells die, the proteins that made up its cells break down, and that's when the amino acids like glutamic acid, which is naturally found in many fruits and vegetables, get released. And that's the thing that gives nutritional yeast that kind of umami flavor. So it is like the yeast that we use all the time when we're baking.
So it's been referred to as Cheeto dust.
I actually have never heard that.
Maybe it's an LA thing.
It makes sense, you know, because it is used for cheesy flavor. You know, in my experience, you know, we're adding it to like a tahini Caesar to make a vegan Caesar salad dressing or making a cashew cheese sauce. You know, you add a couple of tablespoons of nutritional yeast and that's really where that flavor comes from. It gets combined with miso a lot in order to, you know, really make that kind of salty flavor pop. And, you know, also vegans tend to use it the way omnivores use Parmesan cheese, kind of just sprinkling it on salads, putting it on pasta, that sort of thing.
Does it change the texture of dishes?
Not really. It's not something that you really cook with. If you cook with it, then yes, it is going to perhaps change the texture. But if you're using it as just a flavor additive in something like a cashew cheese or a salad dressing, then it's not going to change the texture. People have found that it does work as a dough relaxer when you're making noodles that you really want a lot of elasticity with. And so it has the capacity to do that, but it's not something that anyone is using to really, you know, provide texture. It's really thought of as a flavoring.
So this use as a dough relaxer, I find really fascinating. How does that work?
Well, recipe developer Tim Chin, he wrote about this for Serious Eats. He was trying to make a recipe for hand-pulled lamian noodles, and you know, there was a Dovrelaxer that was used in China, but that he couldn't get his hands on at the moment. It also wouldn't have been that accessible to home cooks in the United States. And so he tried a few different things. And that's when he found out that nutritional yeast contains glutathione, which is a naturally occurring compound that relaxes gluten and produces a dough with the repeatable extensibility that you want in a hand-pulled noodle. So that lets you really pull on it and get new elasticity every time. And so he got really, really scientific about this process and, you know, refined it into something that would work for a home cook. And it's really interesting because nutritional yeast not only did the best job out of, you know, the other sort of dough relaxers that were a bit less accessible that he was trying. And so it not only provided the best capability for dough relaxing, it's also an ingredient that's now on supermarket shelves everywhere, which is super interesting.
I'm really curious if using it as part of one's pantry can lead to sort of a flavor fatigue of its particular flavor.
It probably can. I used to rely on nutritional yeast a lot. When I first became vegan in 2011, you know, nutritional yeast, I would put it on everything. Now I don't use it really as much unless I'm going to make that cheese sauce for nachos or something like that. And so it is something that is kind of a bridge a lot of the time for people who are cutting back on dairy or cutting back on animal products to get them over that hump where they really want that cheesy flavor. And other than that, though, I think, you know, if you use it sparingly, if you use it, you know, just to give a little flavor here and there, it's you're not going to get too tired of it. I think it's got a flavor that is one of those staple flavors. And that's why it has been so important to vegans. And I think that for anyone who wants to, you know, sometimes not go for, you know, grating Parmesan on a salad and wants to instead just throw some nutritional yeast on it and feel a little more healthful that day, that I think that can provide some balance.
That's so interesting. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show to speak to us about nutritional yeast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Alicia Kennedy writes about food from Puerto Rico. You can find her byline all over the internet, but I highly recommend her newsletter, From the Desk of Alicia Kennedy. Here's a good use for nutritional yeast, vegan nacho cheese. Tomorrow's the Super Bowl, after all. We've got some ideas for plant-based game day snacks next.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. What does it take for 19 NFL football players to adopt a plant-based diet? Try comparing their body to a Lamborghini and meat to regular gas. That's exactly what Charity Morgan did when she started cooking 100% plant-based meals for the Tennessee Titans. Charity has a brand new book out with some favorite game day snacks that will keep you fueled as you watch our Los Angeles Rams take on the Cincinnati Bengals tomorrow. Hi, Charity.
Hello. Hello, Evan.
So you grew up with Creole and Puerto Rican parents. You must have seen a lot of meat on the dinner table. Did the spices you grew up eating carry over into the repertoire of your plant-based diet that evolved?
Honestly, that has been my secret weapon of teaching people plant-based and how to achieve amazing flavors and not feel like you're sacrificing anything. It's tapping into your roots, tapping into your flavors and those spices in order to bring those things through and not feel like you're sacrificing anything.
Yeah, I mean, I often think about how much the familiarity of the food we grow up with is such a like touchstone of identity, and the idea of going completely off-road must come with a lot of loss.
Yes. In 2015, I tried to go plant-based and I failed miserably. And I found that connection of why I failed. It's one, I didn't know my reason why. Two, it was all these like memories and things that I had as a child that I felt like I was losing out on, you know, having all that culture and my Puerto Rican background and my Creole and Cajun roots were just gone. And I was like, hold on, that's not life to me. And I had to actually identify it to real people, real memories. And that's what food does for people. It brings back memory. I mean, think about your grandmother, think about your mother. Those are beautiful memories that I'm not trying to take away from my plate or even someone else's.
What was the issue or the idea that kind of pushed you to go vegan initially?
It was actually my husband at the time, Tennessee linebacker Derek Morgan, who started for the team for 9 years. Every year it was something. It was something new on what he was going to do to improve performance. And at that time in 2017, he decided it was going to be nutrition. And so he hired a nutritionist. The nutritionist came back with all this like, hey, these are things that you can do to lower inflammation in the body. And as you know, inflammation leads to injury. Inflammation leads to disease. So these are the things that we want to cut down on. So what's the quickest and fastest way of doing that? By what's on your plate.
So we've used vegan and plant-based interchangeably. You coined the term pleganism. How do you define that?
When I first went vegan, I got a lot of, well, how can you say you're vegan when you don't do this? And how can you say you're vegan when you don't do that? And, you know, how can you say that your clients and your NFL players are vegan when they play with a football, you know? It was just like all these parameters and all these rules that it frustrated me. It pissed me off. And I said, take your rules and go somewhere else. I'm going to create my own game because that isn't inspiring. That doesn't make me want to be vegan. That makes me want to say, screw you and everything that you stand for. And I didn't want to take it out on the message and the movement. It was more so like, okay, you do what you're doing over there. That kind of vegan works for you. But for me and my clients and people that want to try this, they want to try it without feeling judged. I'm an adult. I don't want to feel like I'm not vegan enough for your standards. And so I coined the phrase plegan because I wanted something that's more inclusive, that lets people know, look, if you're eating plant-based for 3 weeks, but then you slipped up and you accidentally ate a chicken wing, that I'm not going to be like, oh my God, you're not vegan enough for me. Like, no, you can't be a part of our club, because that's what I was feeling when I came on. And then again, it's a small percentage of people that were doing that to me. But the simple fact that I had to deal with that, when I'm like, we're on the same team, guys. Like, I'm teaching these guys how to re-eat the things that they love with new ingredients. And I got so much backlash and it was just nasty. I didn't like the way I felt. And I said, here I am as a chef. I know what to do with food. So I can only imagine how overwhelming this can feel when you aren't a chef and you don't know what to do with food.
So I would love to hear what you're going to be eating tomorrow for the big game. What are a few of your favorites?
So I usually do the things that feed a crowd and the crowd loves. And so I've already got requests to make my vegan nachos, where they're huge nacho platter with my walnut chorizo that's in my book as well. And then I put my plant-based cheese on it. My husband, Derek, loves my lemon pepper wings, and I make those out of cauliflower. And he usually loves a big salad and some chili. So that's where we're going with it.
So I'm really curious about your lemon pepper wings. Take us through the recipe briefly, if you could.
The hero of that recipe is this super wet, zesty lemon sauce that I put on it. However, I use, you know, a lemon pepper seasoning inside of the dredge. And the great thing about it is it's taking a traditional, let's just say a buffalo cauliflower wing, but instead of us tossing it in a butter hot sauce, we're going to pour this lemon zest, lemon juice, lots of bits of garlic in it, and some spices that pull together this super zesty wing sauce. And I toss it in it. And it's just this moment that you have when you're eating them. It's a moment. It's a mood. It's a moment. It's a vibe.
I love that. You shared with us that you failed at completely committing to a plant-based diet the first time around. What are some small steps that the vegan curious can take to learn from your experience?
Well, as you know, plant-based and vegan right now is very trendy. That can't be the reason why you want to go plant-based. That's my number one I tell people. You need to know your why, because your why is going to be the thing that continues to power you. For me, it was for health. I wanted to feel the best version of Charity. I hated the way I felt. I didn't love that I hit, you know, 2-3 o'clock and I was feeling like I just hit a brick wall and I didn't have any energy and I was fatigued. Number two is, until you become a pro at this, you're going to have to plan. Plan. Sit down, take a day out the week and say, all right, what does my breakfast, lunch, and dinner look like? Like literally journal what you're eating in a week. And that gives you a snapshot of what the things you can eat throughout the week. If you notice, oh, I eat a lot of avo toast. Well, guess what? That's already vegan if you just take the egg off of it or something, or the cream cheese. Or we do Taco Tuesday every week. Okay, super duper easy. Do you know how many things you can make a taco out of? It's using that, all the possibilities, instead of this, what I can't have. When you tap into the world of creativity, you realize that you have hundreds of thousands of different ingredients at your fingertips, opposed to the 2 to 5 ingredients that you cannot have.
I've so enjoyed meeting you. Thank you so much, Charity.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
That was Charity Morgan. She is a chef and author. You can find the recipes we've talked about in her book, Unbelievably Vegan, 100 plus life-changing plant-based recipes. And if you just want to focus your energy on the game and stay out of the kitchen, Los Angeles has no shortage of restaurants. We're ready to feed you. Shelley Leopold is the editor of Discover LA, and she joins us with a few ideas for game day takeout. Hi.
Hello.
So let's start with the statement item. If we really want to lean into the Super Bowl theme this year, what would you recommend we pick up as our centerpiece?
Oh, well, no question. It's the Little John's English Toffee House at the Farmer's Market. They've created an edible chocolate football that you can fill with pretzels, chips, anything you want. It's really very cool and a fun centerpiece for your game. And also on the same edible football theme, John and Vinny's has created a double chocolate football cake along with their specialty game day menu of heroes and meatballs and pizzas off their regular menu.
That sounds really good. And I just want to chime in and say that the chocolate at Little John's is a really great quality, so you don't have to sacrifice the quality of your chocolate just to follow a theme. What about a plant-based game day spread that you don't have to make yourself?
Well, Akasha in Culver City is doing her vegan chili for the game. Sage Vegan Bistro in Echo Park is offering a free large order of their very popular buffalo cauliflower dish with the purchase of their new Sage Brew beer, which touts itself as a woman-owned brewery and one of the only hop yards in LA. So they farm everything locally.
Gosh, that's fantastic. And what if you want to watch the game in person with a beer in your hand?
Well, if you want to get fancy, there's the rooftop at the Godfrey Hotel in Hollywood. It's a really beautiful view up there, and it's hosting a 70-foot projection mapping screen. But if you want more of a salt-of-the-earth style celebration, Tom's Watch Bar in downtown LA is a 360-degree viewing room with 150 screens and what they're calling a U-Pour area, with 50 self-serve beer taps that you can serve yourself with.
That's pretty amazing. 150 screens. Yeah, you'll need some beer for that one.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what about if we want to go in the direction of barbecue or something smoked?
Wow. Well, plenty of options there too, but I would recommend probably Bledsoe's. He is, as you know, a legacy business in LA, and he's an official supplier for the NFL for the weekend. So, you know, probably all the players are eating Bledsoe's barbecue as well. His pre-order is live now and includes beer and cocktail packages along with his amazing food. And, but don't sleep on making those pre-orders because he will sell out. And for those of you listeners who don't live in LA, you can get it shipped via Goldbelly. So you won't miss out.
What about, even if we're not going to the game in person, we still want to support the businesses in Inglewood?
Well, Taste of Inglewood is going on today, Saturday, until 10 tonight on Market Street, which would be a great way to kind of familiarize yourself with the Inglewood businesses on Market Street if you don't know them already. I would recommend Chef Babette's Stuff I Eat. She's been open since 2008, and it's delicious plant-based food. And then there's Doolin's Soul Food. It's an institution, and they already celebrate Soul Food Sunday, and happens to fall on Super Bowl as well. So they would be great.
Well, thank you so much, Shelley. So many really, really good recommendations.
Thank you very much, Evan.
Shelley Leopold is the editor at Discover LA, where she put together a list of places to eat, drink, and take out for Super Bowl Sunday. We've got a link to her full list on our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. In a minute, the fascinating story of Georgia Gilmore, whose fried chicken sandwiches, spicy collard greens, and sweet potato pies helped fuel the Montgomery bus boycott. Stay with us. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Black communities have used food as a form of protest for centuries. Enslaved Africans were known to braid rice and seeds in their hair during the transatlantic slave crossing, not only as a reminder, but as a means of rebellion. A new children's picture book illustrates the overlooked story of a woman who used her famous crispy chicken and pies to fund a movement. Mara Rockliff is the author of Sweet Justice. Hi, Mara.
Hi, Evan.
So tell us, who is Georgia Gilmore?
Like so many people fighting for justice both then and now, she was an apparently ordinary person who turned out to be extraordinarily courageous and resourceful. She grew up in poverty in Montgomery, Alabama. She raised 6 children on her own. Martin Luther King called her an unlettered woman of unusual intelligence, which kind of speaks to her lack of opportunity under segregation. She cleaned houses for white people, which was, you know, like many Black women, not because they were suited for that, but because that was all that was open to them. When the story starts, she's cooking at the National Lunch Counter in Montgomery. And she was also a skilled midwife in the Black community, so her kids would remember filling in at the lunch counter when she had to run off and deliver a baby.
What were some of her own experiences of segregation in Montgomery?
Well, it touched every part of your life. I mean, she couldn't take her children to the park. At the lunch counter where she worked, the white waitresses would serve the food she cooked while she had to stay hidden in the kitchen. By city ordinance, there was a partition that was a minimum 7 feet high between Black and white customers at this lunch counter eating the same food. You know, and then there was the bus where, you know, she'd be on her feet all day. If the seats in the back were full, then she would have to stand even if the front was empty. It was, I guess, the bus that finally did it for Georgia. The driver, one time made her pay at the front, you know, and then get out and walk to the back door, which was a common rule, but he was particularly nasty about it that day. And before she could even get back on, he drove away when she'd already paid her 10 cents. So she decided that she wouldn't give that bus company another dime. She would walk instead. And the thing about Georgia Gilmore, somebody who knew her described her as a woman of great physical stature. Her son claimed she was between 350 and 400 pounds. So this is a very large woman on her feet all day, and she was willing to walk all alone. You know, this one woman boycott of the bus company. And this was 2 months before Rosa Parks.
So then the arrest of Rosa Parks happens when she refuses to get up from her seat in the front of the bus, which launches the bus boycott in Montgomery. What was George's contribution?
Everybody who was involved in the boycott knew that it was going to take courage and persistence and hard work, but also money. Not everybody, you know, lived close enough to walk to work or school. So they were organizing carpools. They were trying to figure out how to pay for gas. And then they had more and more need for money because the police were cracking down on this boycott. They would, you know, just basically make up laws. They would give tickets to Black drivers who were giving people a ride. If you were waiting on the corner for a ride, you'd be arrested for loitering. So, you know, the organizers of the boycott had to come up with paying for these fines and these tickets. People were losing their jobs. They needed financial help. So this is where Georgia Gilmore stepped up. She didn't have any money, really, but she and her friends, you know, put together their quarters and their 50 cents, and she went out and got ingredients and made chicken sandwiches to sell at the mass meetings that they had at the Holt Street Baptist Church. And from there, she branched out to selling meals and desserts all over town. She was famous for her fried chicken, her meatloaf, her hot pepper vinegar on collard greens, her stuffed pork chops, black-eyed peas, hot rolls, potato salad, stuffed bell peppers, spare ribs, macaroni, lima beans. Her sweet potato pies were legendary. All her desserts were legendary. Her son was interviewed once, and he said she cooked pound cake, German chocolate cake, red velvet cake, 7-Up cake, sour cream cake. He said she could make the peach pie and the banana pudding that would make you slap your brains out, which sounds really good.
Yeah, a woman with a huge repertoire.
Yeah. So people helped her cook and they gave her money kind of on the sly, both Black people and white people, but they were scared. They didn't want to lose their jobs. They didn't want to have their houses bombed. So Georgia kept their identities a secret. She called them the Club from Nowhere. And Georgia wasn't scared. I mean, every week they would have these mass meetings at the Holt Street Baptist Church and, you know, Martin Luther King would speak. And then Georgia would march right up there in front of these white policemen who were there taking down names. And she'd dump out the money she'd earned that week and she'd say, "This is from the Club from Nowhere." And it was always more than anyone else had raised. And everybody would just stomp and cheer. And every meeting she would bring down the house.
So you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that Martin Luther King Jr. knew Georgia. How did he decide to step up and help?
She knew him before the boycott. He lived a few blocks away from her in Centennial Hill. And whenever he had important company, he would hire her to cater. He was a huge fan of her fried chicken, like everybody else. And because he'd been chosen as the spokesman for the boycott, he was a target. His house was bombed, and then he was arrested as, you know, a leader on the grounds that it was illegal to organize a boycott that had no just cause. You know, and of course, it did have a just cause. So Georgia, before he helped her, she helped him. She went down to the courthouse. She very bravely testified publicly about her own experience with that bus driver who yelled at her and made her get off and drove off without her. And there were reporters there from all over the country and the world, and they quoted her talking about how the Black customers deserve to be treated equally. She said, "When they count the money, they do not know Negro money from white money." So the outcome of this trial was that Martin Luther King received a very unfair guilty verdict, and this made him world famous. But meanwhile, Georgia lost her job. The National Lunch Company people saw what she had said in the papers. She was fired. But Dr. King didn't forget what she'd done for him. He told her to go into business for herself, and he gave her money. And she bought pots and pans and started an underground restaurant in her own home. And her house became the center of the boycott and really a center of the whole civil rights movement. It was the only place in Montgomery, Alabama, where Black and white people could sit down and eat together without fear.
You know, this book is so marvelous, not just the story, which you have just researched and which you tell so effectively, but the illustrations are so beautiful and so moving. Who's responsible for them?
They are. They're wonderful. So Sweet Justice was illustrated by R. Gregory Christie. And Greg is a very well-known guy in children's book illustration. He's illustrated books about Sojourner Truth and Richard Wright and other important figures in Black history.
Where did you find most of your research on Georgia Gilmore? And then what was your process to sort of cull down that information to make it understandable for young readers?
Like all of my historical picture books, it involved lots of really fun detective work. The first part was digging up the sources, you know, the original sources, like the newspaper stories at the time, oral histories and memoirs by people who were there, like Joanne Robinson, who was an important organizer, Martin Luther King, the original transcript from his trial, things like that. The second and harder part was figuring out what was true. There's always so many inconsistencies and errors, even in sources that seem reliable. The one that was the most striking to me is there's actually a historical marker outside the house where Georgia Gilmore used to live. It's cast metal lettering. I mean, it's practically like it's carved in stone, right? So you think it has to be trustworthy. And this marker has just a few sentences, but I found three factual statements on it that are actually incorrect, including the day she died. The marker says she died on March 3rd, 1990. Her gravestone says that she died 6 days later on March 9th. And honestly, I'm not even sure that I trust a gravestone anymore, so I still double-checked it.
Well, Mara, I just want to thank you for creating such a fantastic book for kids and teens, and for adults, for that matter. It's just a very engaging book that tells a story that we need to hear.
Thank you.
Mara Rockliff is a children's book author. Her latest work is Sweet Justice, Georgia Gilmore and the Montgomery Bus Boycott. Rome wasn't built in a day, neither was the Italian restaurant Bacchetti. From concept to opening, the Echo Park sibling to the wine bar Tilda was years in the making. Partners Jason Goldman and architect Christian Stainer took their time building the perfect space, and LA Times restaurant critic Bill Addison thinks it was worth the wait. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Evan. Great to hear your voice.
So I guess I would really love to talk about the space before we even get to the menu, because people are really talking about that.
It's built into a building originally constructed in 1928, and it has this real sense of spaciousness. It almost feels like a modernist cabin. It has this very stylish mix of materials, almost kind of a mid-century feel with its splashes of teal and orange and mustard, but all these beautiful exposed beams and interior windows. It really gives the space this wonderful kind of connected coziness and stylishness.
It sounds lovely.
It is. It's only 90 seats inside and outside. And there is, you know, I'm still thinking very consciously about covering restaurants that have an outdoor component for diners who are leaning in that direction, as I am these days. But, you know, it's exciting. If you are eating inside, it's an exciting place to be. And if you're not, They have a cozy kind of constructed space right along the sidewalk that still gives a little bit of intimacy to the dining experience, and lots of heat lamps in the Los Angeles winter. And you're facing the window, so you can kind of still catch the wave of the vibe that's happening.
So let's talk about the food. And I suppose we should start with the focaccia because that kind of centers us a bit.
Yes, it is a riff off the pizza ebraica, which I'm sure you're familiar with, Evan. This is very much your métier. A Swedish pizza of sorts. Meaning slightly sweet, from the Jewish Roman repertoire. And they have recreated it into a focaccia with sort of beautiful kind of round pull-apart layers flavored with black olives and currants and rosemary. It's the early standout from chef Joel Stovall, whose most notable previous gig to this was as chef de cuisine at Joseph Centeno's Orsa in Winston, one of my favorites in the city.
Yeah, what a great pedigree.
Do you know this dish?
Of course. Sometimes it's presented almost like a cookie.
Ah.
It's unique and very, very difficult to replicate. I haven't yet been to Bacchetti, but I'm interested in trying this savory take on it. Given their threat, this thread of Roman cuisine, do they dig deep into the classic canon of pastas?
Yes and no. As with so many restaurants in America and Los Angeles, there is always this not to tradition, but also some individualism kind of creeping in. So you get three out of the four, what I think of as very classic Roman pastas. The cacio e pepe, which they serve a little heretically, I would say, with strozza preti, the priest stranglers, that shape of pasta. The amatriciana, made with rigatoni. I know that that's often made with bucatini traditionally. And then a carbonara that has the bucatini. So they're mixing and matching traditional shapes and sauces, but I think it really translates beautifully.
I mean, the menu is nice and small. It seems like it's a really good edit. What were some other dishes that you just really enjoyed?
A couple other nods to the Roman lexicon that I really enjoyed were the supli, which I liked that they leaned in to variations that felt familiar to me when I've had them in Rome. Chicken gizzards is part of one, adds great texture. There's also one with ribeye. I love that they call them supli al telefono, which is charming because when you break those croquettes in half and pull the stringy mozzarella, they resemble telephone lines. There's also a Roman-style gnocchi, which are made in round, flat cakes with semolina flour rather than potato, and they're baked with Parmesan. That's a standout as well.
So good.
Yeah, so good. And fun to see that variation in this city. I haven't noticed that too much. And then the menu rounds out with just some nice big plates to share. There's a kind of a variation on like breaded Milanese style meats using rack of lamb, which is fun. And the beloved branzino variation in this town here, flavored with gremolata and marjoram. It's really nice. Another soothing wintry dish, braised beef cheek with chard and pine nuts over polenta. Just good warming food and a great Italian wine list to go with it. Not too crazy expensive. And a nice contrast to Tilda, which really homes in on kind of the funkier California natural wine movement that's going on these days.
Well, you folks who live in Echo Park are very lucky.
Well, I will meet you there anytime, Evan, so say the word.
Thank you so much, Bill.
Thanks, Evan.
That was Bill Addison, restaurant critic for the Los Angeles Times. We've been talking about Bacchetti in Echo Park. You can find Bill's recommendations on our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up, A brand new vendor joins the Santa Monica Farmers Market. We've got the scoop on the market report next. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. This week, a new vendor joined the Santa Monica Farmers Market. And no, he's not growing vegetables. Jillian Ferguson brings us this report from a new shrimp farm in Downey.
This is Jillian Ferguson with a special edition of The Market Report. I'm reporting today from Downey, where I'm excited to meet a brand new vendor who will be joining the Wednesday Santa Monica Farmers Market. Steve Sutton is the founder of Transparency, a 300,000-gallon facility where he is cultivating chemical-free shrimp. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Jillian. Thanks for having me.
So, Steve, you've been harboring this idea for 8 years now, and it's finally coming online. You've already started selling to some of our favorite chefs in LA, but you took a pretty circuitous path to get here. I know you worked for NOAA and fisheries management. You actually moved to Thailand, learned Thai, and worked at a shrimp farm there so you could understand the industry and what was really going on. Tell us what about those experiences led you to open Transparency.
So I would say not every job that I've taken was intentional, but most of them were. Taking the job in Thailand was totally by design because I already had the idea for a shrimp farm. And the reason shrimp is because we eat more shrimp than any other seafood in this country, about 4.5 pounds per person averaged across the whole country. I think in Southern California, we eat more than the average. Most of our shrimp comes from India. Most of it's frozen 3 to 6 months. Almost all of it's treated with some sort of preservative. So that was one reason for shrimp. The other reason is that generally, broadly speaking, the fundamental sciences and practices of farming shrimp in wild habitats or fishing for shrimp in the ocean are some of the most destructive practices that we have in the world as it relates to seafood. So I thought low-hanging fruit, big market, they grow fast, the whole product is useful, meaning there's flavor from the whole thing. You don't have to fillet and process it all. So for me, it's a good place to start. I do hope that, you know, other farmers will develop farms that are similar with other products and that, you know, 10 or 20 years from now, we'll be looking at a very different scene.
And what kind of shrimp are you raising? Are they shrimp or are they prawns? And maybe you can explain to us once and for all what the difference is.
So we're growing a species called commonly or sort of correctly called Pacific white leg prawns. Now, these are marketed under white shrimp. The market of seafood, as it's done with many things over the decades, has sort of conflated prawn and shrimp. And it's not unique to the United States, but it sort of can mean, you know, people assume prawn is maybe more expensive or fancier or bigger. And that just depends on the market and how it's being sold. Spot prawn, for example, the beautiful, wonderful California treasure that is a well-managed fishery, by the way, those are actually shrimp. So they're more closely related to the freshwater aquarium shrimp than they are to a prawn.
So talk to us about the growing practices. How do you nurture a little tiny baby prawn from a hatchling to a mature adult that's ready to come to market?
So they arrive from domestic hatcheries. And so we receive 15, 17-day-old little prawns. They're about a third the size of your pinky nail. They come in and we warm them up. So they come in cold and hungry. We warm them up slowly. We reduce the salinity slowly. Then we acclimate them over the course of a few hours and get them into our system. They start in their own nursery tank. So they're isolated with their own pump and heater. And then we closely monitor their health. We get them a high protein feed.
And how big are you trying to get them?
Our target is about 1 ounce, so it's about 16 per pound. When we hit our stride later this spring, we should be at about 1,500 pounds per week as our max capacity. So to put that in perspective, it should be around 70 to 80,000 pounds per year, and that's about 0.05% of what Southern California consumes per year. So when you walk through the farm and you say, yeah, it's a small shrimp farm, but it's pretty big. I mean, there's a lot of water. There's a lot of animals. And then you think about that you would need 40 of these farms to get to 2% of the product that we eat.
Unbelievable. So the chefs have already found you, which leads me to believe that it's not just about the sustainability, but it's about the flavor of your product. How does the flavor of what you're doing differ than what maybe Americans are used to getting at the grocery store?
really, I think it's the freshness. So the fact that we harvest the same morning that we bring to market gives them a different experience altogether when it comes to texture. You know, they start out pretty firm, and chefs sometimes are like, wow, I didn't realize it could be this firm. You know, aside from maybe a spot prawn that comes in live or a lobster, they just don't have that experience with this type of prawn.
So what do people need to know when they get home from the market with this product? How do you treat it?
So we harvest them whole. We don't add preservatives or salt. We're freezing some for the market now. We're kind of working with that. If you're buying that product, you know, you want to thaw it over a few hours, but don't let it sit out for too long. One thing people don't realize is you want to thaw something in the same salinity that it is made in. So this is about half the salinity of the ocean. So you don't really want to thaw any saltwater fish in freshwater. It starts to absorb water. The edges will start to kind of turn white and curl up. We want to just like, look, it's shrimp that's been harvested right out of the water into ice water. You know, it's killed as humanely as possible in about 15 to 30 seconds. Then it's sorted within minutes and then goes right into a fridge. And then we bag it, we seal it, and we get it to the market or to the chef. We don't use preservatives that would reduce enzymatic activity that cause something called oxidation or melanosis. That is simply the darkening of the head and some of the appendages, so it'll turn black. That doesn't mean it's spoiled, but it doesn't look as appealing anymore, right? So that happens around day 3 if kept properly. So what we want you to do is just use it within 2 to 3 days. You want to cook it quickly on high heat and don't overcook it. I love to have it just grilled with a little bit of salt, a little bit of oil, maybe some citrus, maybe some herbs. That's about it. But you can do almost anything with it.
Fascinating. Well, thank you so much for what you're doing, and we are thrilled to have you at the market.
Thank you so much for coming. It's been fun talking with you.
That was Steve Sutton, the founder, the brains behind Transparency. You can find his shrimp at the Wednesday Santa Monica Farmers Market, also on Sundays at the Long Beach Farmers Market, and in the freezer section at Juice to Grocer. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, Elena Shatkin, Desmond Taylor, and Nick Lamponi. And special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Gary Mazzija, and Kenny Ng. I'm Evan Kleiman. Go Rams! And happy Valentine's Day to all of you. I'll be back next week with a brand new episode of Good Food.